it's time for the Des Moines Register on Thursday, February 8. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of Iowans with a print disability. My name is Twyla Glenn, and my partner at the microphone for the next 90 minutes is Linda Lundgren. For the first hour, we'll cover local and national news from the Des Moines Register and with some from the USA Today. Our second hour starts with birthdays and obituaries, followed by opinions, sports, and lifestyle news. We'll wrap up our broadcast with Dear Abby. Support for today's reading comes from the Des Moines Register and donations from individuals and listeners like you. Learn how you can keep the volunteer Voices of IRIS going strong at iowaradioreading.org. Now let's take a look at the weather and headlines from today's Des Moines Register. According to AccuWeather, across the state, we should see mostly cloudy skies, becoming windier and milder today. A little rain only during the morning in the west, winds south to southwest 15 to 25 miles per hour. And the forecast through the weekend for central Iowa looks like this. Today and tonight, look for a high of 60 and a low of 35. Increasingly windy today with occasional rain. It should be mild, though, all day long. Winds south-southwest 15 to 25 miles per hour. Mostly cloudy tonight. On Friday, partly sunny and mild with a high of 48 and a low of 28. On Saturday, partly sunny and cooler with a high of 41 and a low of 25. On Sunday, mostly sunny with a high of 41 and a low of 24. Looking at precipitation, in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Wednesday, there was zero precipitation. The month to date, we've had zero precipitation against a normal of 29 hundredths of an inch. Our year to date has been 1.91 inches of precipitation against a normal of 1.37 inches. Last year at this time, we had had 1.64 inches of precipitation. As for snowfall in the 24 hours ending 4 p.m. Wednesday, we've had zero. The month to date, also zero. The normal month to date would be 2.8 inches because hard to believe from these temperatures, but it is February. Our season to date, 30 inches. Normal season to date would be 23.3 inches. Sunrise today was at 7:19 a.m. and sunset tonight at 5:39 p.m. Moonrise today at 6:52 a.m. Moonset today at 4:04 p.m. Turning now to the front page of the Register, the lead stories reads, all-time great Hawkeyes star Caitlin Clark is on pace for an NCAA scoring record. The other two articles look like this. A bill would require parental okay in order to open social media accounts, and the House fails to muster enough votes for the Mayorkas impeachment. And now with our lead story is our resident women's football fan, Linda Lundgren.
Okay. Well, I'll read this story about Caitlin. It's also accompanied by a pretty large picture on the front page of her with the basketball in her hand. Looks like she's about to do something with it. It's not often that one of the biggest stories in the sports world is centered on Iowa, but Caitlin Clark is commanding exactly that sort of attention as the Iowa Hawkeyes superstar creeps closer and closer to the all-time NCAA women's basketball scoring record. Barring injury, the relevant question appears less about whether she will break the record and more about when it will happen. Clark has scored 3,462 points, with seven games left in the regular season and more to come in the Big Ten and NCAA tournaments. She sits just 65 points away from Kelsey Plum's record of 3,527. To break the record during the regular season, Clark would need to average just 9.3 points per game. That should be no issue. She's scored fewer than 10 points just once in her 123-game career. This season, she's scored more than 20 points in every single game she's played. Clark is already one of the all-time greats in women's college basketball. Here's how she stacks up to the rest of them. A 35-point performance last week moved Clark past Missouri State legend Jackie Stiles and Ohio State star Kelsey Mitchell for second on the all-time scoring list. But she hasn't simply scored more points than them. She's done it in fewer games, and in some cases, significantly fewer. Through February 4th, Clark has played in 123 games. Stiles played 129, Mitchell played 139, and Brittany Griner, fifth on the all-time list, played 148. Clark has more points than all of them. That's thanks to a points-per-game pace that rates second in NCAA history. Only Patricia Huskins, who scored 28.4 points per game in 110 games for Mississippi Valley State in the late 1980s, racked up points faster than Clark. And Clark could catch Huskins. In her last five games, Clark has averaged 37.6 points per game, the best five-game stretch of her career. That's raised her career average to 28.1 points per game. That recent hot streak means that Clark's march through the record books won't be over if she passes Plum. The men's record is also in sight. Pistol Pete Maravich holds the all-time NCAA men's basketball scoring record, racking up more points than any other college basketball player, male or female, in NCAA history. Maravich's stat line is so extreme, it looks almost alien. He scored 44.2 points per game in three seasons at LSU, totaling 3,667 points in 83 games, all before the three-point line was implemented. That points-per-game record looks nigh unbreakable, but Antoine Davis came 3 points from breaking his career points record last year with Detroit Mercy. And now, Caitlin Clark has Maravich in her sights. Clark enters the final seven games of the regular season 205 points behind Maravich. She'll need to average a little more than 29 points per game across that stretch to break his all-time NCAA record by the end of the regular season. She's already averaging more than that this season. Add in a deep postseason run, and that target looks even more attainable. Clark has one more hurdle to surpass before Maravich, however. Even if she passes Plum to become the all-time NCAA women's scoring leader, she still won't be the all-time women's college basketball scoring leader. That's because Lynette Woodard scored 3,649 in her collegiate career at Kansas. That was before the NCAA officially sponsored women's basketball. As a result, Woodard's stats aren't included in the official NCAA record book. Clark would need 187 points in her remaining games to pass Woodard and become the undisputed all-time scoring leader in women's college basketball. That would require averaging 26.7 points per game during the rest of the regular season, and fewer if Iowa were to play deep into March. All of this assumes, of course, that Clark decides not to return for her fifth year of eligibility, awarded because of the COVID-19 pandemic. If she were to return, surpassing all these scoring milestones would be elementary. Anyone who's watched a Hawkeyes game during Clark's career could tell you she contributes far more to the team than just shooting. If it's not Clark putting the ball in the hoop, there's a good chance one of her teammates is scoring off of one of her passes. And even if field goals aren't falling, Clark often finds herself at the free throw line. Clark's all-around game means she rates highly on the NCAA leaderboards in many categories beyond points and points per game. Her prowess from distance is well known, and she ranks fifth all-time in three-pointers made. She'll likely jump to at least third on that list over her next few games. If she maintains her career pace of about 8 assists per game, Clark will become the sixth player in NCAA history to record 1,000 career assists. Clark is also 10th in free throws made since 2001, a testament to her ability both to get to the line and to convert those opportunities into points. And we're not done. Then there are triple-doubles. Clark is just the second women's player ever to record 10 or more triple-doubles, which perhaps says the most about how well-rounded her game is. A triple-double is defined as reaching double figures, 10 or more, in three of the five main basketball statistical categories: points, rebounds, assists, steals, and blocks. The most common combination is points, rebounds, and assists. Clark is at 15 triple-doubles for her career. It would take a Herculean effort over her remaining regular season and postseason games to surpass the 26 recorded by Sabrina Ionescu of the Oregon Ducks from 2016 to 2020. But then again, it's Caitlin Clark. Would you be surprised?
Not me. Sounds exciting. Moving on, the House fails to muster enough votes for Mayorkas impeachment. This is a short story from the front page, and we'll follow it up with a story from the inside about how Iowa's GOP Congress members voted. But first, this front page story. The House rejected a GOP push Tuesday to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, a significant blow to the Republicans trying to make immigration and the border a top issue heading into the 2024 elections. The vote failed by a count of 214 to 216 to not impeach Mayorkas, with no Democrats supporting the move and a handful of Republicans joining them. It was always a heavy lift for House Republican leaders to push the impeachment effort, though considering their razoring. Let me start that sentence again. It was always a heavy lift for House Republican leaders to push the impeachment effort through, considering their razor-thin majority in the lower chamber. House Republicans voted on two articles of impeachment, accusing Mayorkas of, what, quoting now from the articles of impeachment, willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and a breach of public trust. That's the end of the quote. Mayorkas, GOP lawmakers argue, has intentionally allowed the crisis at the border to continue. But Democrats, a small number of Republicans, and legal experts across the political spectrum have long dismissed Republicans' impeachment push. They say the GOP grievances with Mayorkas amount to nothing more than policy disagreements over how to handle the border and America's immigration system. Impeaching him, they say, would set a dangerous precedent for future impeachments. And some Republicans also raise questions about the push to impeach the secretary. Representative Tom McClintock, a Republican of California, released a statement Tuesday saying nothing would change even if Mayorkas were removed from office. Even if the House did approve the articles, the prospect of removing Mayorkas from his office faced long odds in the Senate, which has the power to hold a trial to remove an impeached official. And so moving to the interior of the Register's front page section, I'll read this article entitled How Iowan Republicans Voted on Mayorkas' Impeachment. Iowa's four Republican congressional delegates voted in lockstep Tuesday to impeach Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas, but the impeachment effort died on a 214 to 216 vote. The House voted largely along party lines, even as House Republicans are rejecting a bipartisan deal to address the crisis on the southern border with Mexico. But four Republicans ultimately voted against impeachment, enough to sink the measure. The House voted on two articles of impeachment, accusing Mayorkas of a willful and systemic refusal to comply with the law and a breach of public trust. Mayorkas, GOP lawmakers argue, has intentionally allowed the crisis at the border to continue. Here's what Iowa's congressional delegation voted on the Mayorkas impeachment and what they had to say. First, First District U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks. U.S. Representative Marionette Miller Meeks, a Republican who represents Southeast Iowa, voted to impeach. She did not issue a statement on her vote. Second District U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson. U.S. Representative Ashley Hinson, a Republican who represents Northeast Iowa, posted on social media that, quote, "This is a solemn day, but we must impeach," end quote. She blamed Mayorkas for rash of fentanyl deaths in America, although most of those drugs come through controlled border crossings. Quoting again from Hinson, "Secretary Mayorkas is complicit in the deaths of Americans poisoned by fentanyl," Hinson wrote. "He bears responsibility for suspected terrorists on our soil. He is to blame for the violence against Americans at the hands of illegal immigrants," she said. After the vote, Hinson released a statement accusing Mayorkas of lying to congressional members 2 years ago. Continuing with quoting Hinson, "At this point, if his mouth is moving, he's lying. I applaud Chairman Tennessee Republican Congressman Mark Green and the House Homeland Security Committee for conducting a thorough investigation into the causes, costs, and consequences of the border crisis that showed Secretary Mayorkas has willfully refused to comply with immigration law and has severely breached public trust. I fully support impeaching Secretary Mayorkas so that we can start to secure the border." That's the end of the quote from Representative Hinson. Moving on to the 3rd District and U.S. Representative Zach Nunn. U.S. Representative Zach Nunn, a Republican who represents Metro Des Moines and Central and Southern Iowa, voted to impeach. He did not issue a statement on his vote. And finally, 4th District Representative Randy Feenstra. U.S. Representative Randy Feenstra, a Republican representing conservative Northwest Iowa, promised in advance to vote for impeachment, posting on social media, "Today, I will vote to impeach Secretary Mayorkas for intentionally failing to secure the border." After his vote, Feenstra issued a statement saying he decided to impeach Secretary Mayorkas for his intentional failure to secure our border and protect our families. Continuing, quoting from Representative Feenstra, "His dereliction of duty has proven catastrophic, not only for communities along the border, but also our rural communities here at home in Iowa. Secretary Mayorkas' unwillingness to close the border and defeat the drug cartels have left too many families mourning the death of a loved one to fentanyl and the opioid crisis. I have repeatedly called on President Biden and Secretary Mayorkas to enforce the laws on the books and restore order at our border. Those calls have fallen on deaf ears, which has reinforced my decision to impeach Secretary Mayorkas." And that's the end of the quote from Representative Feenstra. Linda?
Bill would require parental okay to open social media accounts. Iowa lawmakers want to require anyone under 18 to get permission to create social media accounts, advancing a bill Wednesday that would give parents and guardians more oversight over their children's internet use. House File 2255, sponsored by more than a dozen Republicans, would also seek to allow the Iowa Attorney General and users to sue those companies for violating the parental authorization rules. Representative John Wills, a Republican of Spirit Lake, called it a, quote, "House Republican priority." "This is a bill that we worked on last year quite a bit, and I think it helped to fine-tune the language and get it closer to where we have it today," Wills said. The bill was advanced after a brief subcommittee hearing on a 3-0 vote Wednesday morning. Representative Sammy Sheets, Democrat of Cedar Rapids, said he had questions about how the bill would be enforced, but voted to advance it alongside two Republicans. "As somebody who grew up in the social media age, I understand firsthand how damaging social media can be to the mental health of young people," Sheets said. Under the legislation, Iowans younger than 18 wouldn't be allowed to create an account on a social media platform such as Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok before receiving express permission from a parent or guardian who is allowed to revoke permission at any time. Data collection on children who haven't created accounts with parental permission would be forbidden, and companies would be required to provide the parent or guardian with a password or other means of access to monitor children's posts, private settings, messages, and time spent on the platform. The legislation also grants Iowa's Attorney General the ability to bring a civil lawsuit against any company that violates the parental permission requirements and seek damages totaling $1,000 per violation. It would also allow lawsuits from Iowans harmed using the platform, letting them seek damages of either $10,000 or, if a court determines that the company's violation was a direct cause of the harm, further damages. Lawmakers in several other states, Arkansas, Ohio, and Utah among them, have sought similar restrictions on social media, barring children from creating accounts on platforms without parental consent. But those laws have run into resistance from a tech trade group that includes Snap, Google, TikTok, and Meta, which operates Facebook and Instagram. That group has sued over the laws and has won temporary injunctions in Arkansas and Ohio. Wills, one of the Iowa bill's sponsors, said he believes the legislation is crafted in a way that it should survive a challenge if taken to the courts. "We have basically, in effect, mimicked federal law," he said, pointing to rules barring children 13 and under from using social media without a parent's permission. "What we've done is simply, as a state, we're going to raise it to 17 years old." Multiple conservative religious groups, including the Family Leader, Iowa Catholic Conference, and Iowa Faith and Freedom Coalition, have registered in support of the legislation. TechNet, a trade group whose members include a host of tech companies and social media providers, is opposed to the Iowa bill. Iowa lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have filed legislation this season aiming to place more stringent regulations on social media platforms. A bill filed earlier this week by Senator Janet Peterson, Democrat of Des Moines, which was Senate File 2219, requires platforms to provide a means for Iowans to report material found on a platform that they believe is child sexual abuse, including if the user reporting the material is a minor.
And that concludes the front page stories on the Register. We'll move now to the Metro and Iowa section. And we'll start with the lead story, which is entitled, "Which Metro Cities Will Add the Most People and Jobs by 2050? And it's accompanied by a lovely photograph of the skyline of Des Moines in the evening, taken through the Women's Memorial Bridge, footbridge over the Des Moines River. Even though this story is primarily about the suburbs, I find that kind of an interesting. Here we go. New growth projections through 2015 for Des Moines and its metro areas show which communities may grow the most in terms of the number of jobs, housing units, and people. The Des Moines Metropolitan Planning Organization's Transportation Technical Committee met February 1 and discussed draft employment, housing unit, and population projections. The committee uses the projections to try to determine areas of need for transportation improvements and expected further review of its data. The projections as of February 1 showed population growth continuing at much faster rates in the suburbs than in the capital city, particularly in Waukee, where it's projected to lead the metro with more than a 75% population growth compared to about 14.5% in Des Moines. That would have Waukee grow to a population of nearly 45,500 people by the year 2050, with Des Moines at more than 254,000 people. Altoona, Ankeny, Bondurant, Grimes, and Johnson were all each projected to grow more than 60%. Ankeny was expected to add the largest number of new residents in the metro, more than 45,200 more people, for a new population of more than 120,000. Waukee was projected to have the biggest change in the number of jobs, more than a 94% growth. But it's West Des Moines that's projected to add the biggest number of new jobs in the metro, with more than 38,600 projected to be added there. Des Moines was projected to follow with more than 33,400 new jobs, and then Urbandale with more than 18,600 new jobs. Projections for every metro city showed the rate of growth in housing units keeping up with the population growth. Ankeny, West Des Moines, and Des Moines were projected to add the most new housing units, though Waukee, Altoona, and Bondurant may see the biggest growth rates in their housing stocks. Here are some more projections by community through 2050, according to the MPO's report. Now, these projections, I'm going to read these. They're listed by city, and the cities are listed alphabetically. So that if you're listening for a particular area, listen alphabetically, because these are not listed according to any kind of numerical sorting. So we'll begin with Altoona. Oh, and I'm going to round off some of these numbers so that we don't get lost in too many weeds here. Excuse me. Beginning with Altoona, the number of new jobs, about 2,800. The number of new housing units, about 5,700. Population growth, 14,600 or so. Population in 2050 estimated at a little over 36,000. Ankeny, the number of new jobs, about 7,800. The number of new housing units, about 18,500. The population growth, a little over 45,000. The population in 2015 estimated to be a little over 120,000. In Bondurant, the number of new jobs, a little over 1,000, and the number of new housing units, almost 2,000. Population growth, a little over 5,000, and the population in 2050, just barely over 13,000. Carlisle, the number of new jobs, 723, the number of new housing units, 518, and the population growth, almost 1,300, with an estimated 2050 population of a little over 5,600. In Clive, the number of new jobs, about 9,000. The number of new housing units, about 3,000. Population growth, about 7,700. And the population in 2050, about 25,500. The number of new jobs in Des Moines is estimated to be a little over 33,000, with the number of new housing units a little over 14,000. Population growth over 32,000, and the population in 2015 estimated to be just over 254,000 people. Grimes, the number of new jobs, 6,700. Number of new housing units, 4,500. Population growth, just over 11,000. And the population in 2050, 28,500. Looking at Johnston, the number of new jobs, about 3,200. The number of new housing units, about 6,100. Population growth, about 14,500, with the population in 2050 to be just barely over 38,000. Mitchellville, the number of new jobs, 159. The number of new housing units, 66. The population growth, 170. And the estimated population in the year 2050, 2,600. In Norwalk, the number of new jobs, 1,200. Number of new housing units, almost 3,000. Population growth, 7,300. And the population in 2050, just over 21,000. In Pleasant Hill, the number of new jobs, almost 900. The number of new housing units, just over 2,200. Population growth, just over 5,700. And the population in 2050, just over 16,000. In Polk City, an estimated number of new jobs at 190, with the number of new housing units about 1,200. The population growth, 3,300, and the population in 2050, just over 9,000. Urbandale should see a number of new jobs at 18,600, with the number of new housing units at almost 8,400. Population growth, just over 21,000, and a 2050 population estimate of about 67,500. In Waukee, the number of new jobs, about 7,300. The number of new housing units, just over 8,000. The population growth, about 19,500. And the population in 2050 estimated at about 45,500. In West Des Moines, the number of new jobs at 38,600. The number of new housing units, just over 15,000. The population growth, about 31,500, and the estimated 2050 population topping 100,000 by just about 100,000. Not topping it, but the population being just about 100,000. And finally, Windsor Heights, the number of new jobs, 677. The number of new housing units, 131. The population growth, 302. And Windsor Heights' estimated 2050 population comes in at 5,676.
Wow. Machine gun trial begins for police chief accused of lying to ATF about use of weapons. It's not every day one sees a minigun, an electrified rotary Gatling gun capable of firing 3,000 rounds per minute, being wheeled on a cart into a federal courtroom. That unusual sight marked the first day of the trial in Des Moines of Bradley Wendt, police chief for the small town of Adair and owner of several gun stores. Federal prosecutors say that over several years, he bought or attempted to buy 90 machine guns, ostensibly for use by or demonstration for the two-man Adair Police Department. Many of these weapons were actually for personal use by Wendt or his friends, or for him to resell to private buyers for huge profits, prosecutors say. In total, he faces 15 federal charges on counts of conspiracy, false statements, and illegal possession of a machine gun, the last related to a public machine gun shoot in which Wendt let people pay to fire a military machine gun he had mounted on the top of his personal armored Humvee. Wendt's attorneys insist he was truthful in his communications with the Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives, and that he got the approval of Adair's mayor and city council to buy guns for the department with his own money. Wendt told the ATF all about it from day one, defense attorney Nick Kleinfeld said in his opening statement, telling jurors the evidence would show Wendt had not violated any regulations or laws to obtain the weapons. Prosecutor Ryan Limkuhl, in his opening statement, said Wendt sought the police chief job specifically to be able to apply to get machine guns for his gun store, and that he submitted his first order just 17 days after taking the job. He quoted Wendt's own words to the jury, "Machine guns are worth bank money. You just need the title of police chief." The two-week trial will delve deeply into ATF regulatory procedures and disputes about whether and how much money Wendt made off different transactions. Monday, though, was all about the minigun, which Wendt sought but was unable to obtain. The ATF rejected the proposed transfer after finding that the weapon, usually mounted on a helicopter or other military vehicle, was not suited for law enforcement use. In fact, jurors heard, Wendt made several attempts to purchase a minigun. He first contacted one manufacturer in November 2020, but the company declined to work with him. A since-retired employee testified that Wendt's use of a personal Hotmail email account caused suspicion, and that in any case she thought it extremely unlikely the ATF would approve the sale to a local police agency. Wendt tried again with another manufacturer, which agreed to the sale pending ATF approval and accepted a $40,000 deposit. Text messages introduced as evidence showed Wendt talking about upcoming machine gun shoot events and his hope the minigun would be finished in time, as well as his plan to install it in place of a smaller machine gun on his Humvee. In his demonstration letter, written by Wendt as police chief to Wendt as gun store owner, though, Wendt wrote that the city wanted a demonstration of the weapon because it was, quote, suitable for engagements and suppressive fire with increasingly well-armed criminal suspects. When the ATF rejected the resulting application, Wendt texted the manufacturer saying, they can't say no to a police department. That's just crazy. In pre-trial court filings, Judge Stephen Locher refused to permit some testimony sought by the defense so it could argue, among other things, that Wendt's claim the police department wanted the weapons couldn't be a lie because Wendt controlled the police department. The defense argues that Wendt could not, as a matter of law, have committed the crime of making false statements to ATF through the use of demonstration law letters because Wendt's position as police chief for the Adair Police Department gave him unilateral authority to decide what the Adair Police Department was interested in seeing, Locher wrote, adding that this argument isn't viable under the law and prior court precedent. Locher also ruled that the defense cannot argue Wendt's approval for other ATF licenses suggested the agency condoned his machine gun orders or that the ATF condoned other machine gun shoot events like the one Wendt hosted.
A so-called obscenity bill advances in the state Senate. A bill in the Iowa legislature aims to make exposing minors to what is called obscene performances a crime, with some warning that, as written, it could result in wide-ranging lawsuits and discouraging LGBTQ+ pride parades and drag shows. The legislation, Senate File 2176, would make knowingly exposing anyone under 18 to such a performance a serious misdemeanor, as well as knowingly selling a ticket or admitting a minor to a venue where such a performance is held. The bill defines obscene performance as invoking sexual acts or appeals to the prurient interest and is patently offensive. That's a quote from the proposed bill. Senator Sandy Salmon, a Republican of Janesville who is sponsoring the bill, said, quoting here, obscene performance exposure is exactly what is done to groom children for sexual abuse and exploitation. That's the end of the quote from Senator Salmon. Oh, no, she continues here. It breaks down children's God-given modesty, said Salmon, who last year introduced a bill banning children from attending drag shows. Selman's new bill which a subcommittee advanced Wednesday, does not explicitly name drag shows as obscene performances, but Kenan Crow of One Iowa said that they believe that was what he called the genesis of the legislation. Crow aired concerns Wednesday about language in the bill that allows for a parent or guardian to bring a lawsuit against any person that has knowingly disseminated or exhibited obscene material to a minor and to seek damages or other relief. What I'm worried about is that there will be some extremely litigious activities and activists on this that will bring suit after suit after suit, Crow said. Concerns about the private cause of action language were echoed by two other senators, one of whom honed in on other language banning obscene performances in any public institution or facility. Senator Mike Klemisch, a Republican of Spillville, said, as written, he was worried that it could lead to shotgun lawsuits, that's a quote from him, against a variety of local officials stemming from a public event such as a pride parade. Where does the liability train stop, Klemisch said. Does it stop with city government? Does it stop with the mayor, he asked. Klemisch voted to advance the legislation, but said he wanted to see the bill changed in committee. And Senator Janice Weiner, a Democrat of Iowa City, said she believed the legislation would have what she called a chilling effect on holding parades and drag shows. I believe this is something we should leave to legal professionals, Weiner said. Similar restrictions and penalties specifically aimed at drag shows have been proposed in other states. Tennessee signed into law a ban on the shows on public property and limited them to age-restricted venues. And Missouri lawmakers have proposed bills banning minors from the performance and classifying certain venues as what are called sexually oriented businesses.
Clive designates 15 acres for recreation festivals. A new, almost 15-acre recreation and festival area is coming to Clive on the east side of Northwest 114th Street between Walnut Creek and the Clive Aquatic Center. The Clive City Council on February 1st unanimously approved a site plan for Greenbelt Landing, which will include renovations to the existing special events building, an extended pedestrian and bicycle walkway, fishing pier, playground, and shaded area near where food trucks could park. Improvements to the special events building, which is at 1801 Northwest 114th Street, would include an outdoor patio space with a fireplace. The $10.6 million Greenbelt Landing project is mostly being paid for with $6.6 million of city funds, according to city documents. The remaining $4 million will come from grants and donations, including $800,000 from Variety, the children's charity, and $500,000 each from the Iowa Finance Authority Environmental Protection Agency water quality funding and Polk County funds received through the American Rescue Plan Act. Richard Brown, Clive's Leisure Services Director, told the City Council that about $10 million of the project's budget had been secured. Construction could begin in June this year and be completed in July 2025, according to city documents. Brown said a groundbreaking could be held in May or June. Brown said the aim is to open Greenbelt Landing for Clive Festival in 2025 with a new festival space that could hold between 2,000 and 4,000 people. The annual Clive Festival is a community celebration with live music, food trucks, games, and other entertainment. Water quality improvement features also are part of the project's landscape, including wetlands, stormwater detention ponds, and stream bank stabilization. People will be able to access the pond on an ADA-accessible boardwalk and fishing pier, as well on new ADA access to nearby Walnut Creek. A stormwater treatment wetland of native plant species should improve the quality of the water running off the site, Brown said.
And with this story, we wrap up the Metro in Iowa section. It's entitled, Iowa Clinic Says It's No Longer Accepting Some Medicaid Insurance. The Iowa Clinic, a major multi-specialty medical center in the Des Moines area, is no longer accepting coverage from one of the state's Medicare insurers. Patients with health insurance under Iowa Total Care, one of the managed care organizations offering Medicaid coverage to Iowans, no longer have coverage for their care at Iowa Clinic as of January 24, the clinic confirmed to the Register. Iowa Clinic spokesperson Amy Varco said the organization was not able to reach a new agreement with Iowa Total Care for this year, meaning that the insurer is no longer considered in-network at the Iowa Clinic. Neither Iowa Total Care nor Iowa Clinic has offered details on why the two parties could not agree over a new contract. The Iowa Clinic has declined to share how many patients are impacted by the cut ties with Iowa Total Care. But for those patients, this disagreement means their health insurance will no longer pay for any care they receive at any Iowa Clinic location. The Iowa Clinic is a major provider with multiple locations in the Des Moines area and across central Iowa. Their physicians provide care in more than 40 different specialties. Its main location is the 170,000 square foot facility in West Des Moines. It estimates about 450,000 visits per year across its patient base, according to its website. The Iowa Clinic continues to accept insurance from Iowa's other Medicaid insurers, Molina Healthcare and WellPoint, formerly known as Amerigroup. In a letter to impacted patients sent in November, Iowa Clinic officials encouraged patients to switch managed care organizations in order to continue care. Iowa Total Care did not respond to a request for comment this week. Iowa Medicaid, which oversees the state's managed care organizations, also did not respond to a request for comment.
Well, going back to the main section, how Iowa's U.S. senators voted on the failed border security deal. The bill would have included policies backed by the GOP. Iowa's two Republican U.S. senators have voted against a border security deal their own party members helped negotiate. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst both voted against the border security package that included additional aid to Ukraine, despite Republican lawmakers previously saying they wouldn't approve foreign aid without a border deal. With a 49-50 vote, the Senate voted against advancing the $118 billion package that would appropriate funding for foreign aid and revamp America's border and immigration policies. The reforms would have, among other things, tightened asylum laws and created a new mechanism to shut down the border if illegal crossings reached a certain threshold. Former President Donald Trump railed against the bill well before it was released, increasing pressure on congressional conservatives to reject it. When it finally came out Sunday, around half of Republicans said they opposed it within 24 hours. The emergency aid bill lawmakers pivoted to would appropriate $60 billion for Ukraine's continued war against Russia, which has been attempting to take territory from the small Eastern European country since early 2022. It would also set aside $14 billion for Israel's war against Hamas in Gaza, $9 million for humanitarian assistance in Gaza and elsewhere, and nearly $5 billion for U.S. trade partners in the Indo-Pacific. Here is how Grassley and Ernst voted on the border deal and what they said about it. So the U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, the longest-serving member in the Senate, condemned the border deal before he voted against it, posting on social media that the deal, quote, fails to address the border crisis caused by President Biden's open border policies, plus refusal to enforce our immigration laws that's allowed 8.8 million illegal immigrants counting plus and more counting into our country. Ultimately, the border deal would yield massive discretionary power on border policy to President Biden, his administration. I will not vote to advance a bill that would codify ineffective policies and give President Biden more power to abuse what he has already so badly broken. And what Senator Ernst voted, how she voted against the deal. She did not immediately issue a statement on her vote, but on Tuesday she posted on social media, quote, that if Joe Biden was serious about actually securing the border, he wouldn't sell off our border wall materials for pennies on the dollar.
And here's a story with more background on that border bill. Senate Republicans kill the border and foreign aid deal. Months after Senate Republicans demanded border security legislation in exchange for their support of additional aid to Ukraine, the GOP lawmakers blocked legislation Wednesday that would do just that. But in a last-minute twist, the Senate is poised to advance a separate $95 billion package stripped of border provisions that would appropriate additional funds for Ukraine, Israel, and humanitarian assistance, similar to what President Joe Biden requested in October. With a 49-50 vote, the Senate voted against advancing the $118 billion package that would advance appropriating funding, that would appropriate funding for foreign aid and revamp America's border and immigration policies. The reforms would have, among other things, tightened asylum laws and created a new mechanism to shut down the border if illegal crossings reached a certain threshold. Four Republicans joined with Democrats to attempt to advance the legislation. Moderate Senators Susan Collins, a Republican of Maine, Lisa Murkowski, a Republican of Alaska, and Mitt Romney, a Republican of Utah, and James Lankford, a Republican of Oklahoma, who was the lead GOP negotiator on the bill. Senator Bernie Sanders, an independent of Vermont, and four Democrats voted to defeat it, including Senators Bob Menendez, a Democrat of New Jersey, Alex Padilla, a Democrat of California, Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat of Massachusetts, and Ed Markey, a Democrat of Massachusetts. Former President Donald Trump railed against the bill well before it was released, amping up pressure on congressional conservatives to reject it. When it finally came out Sunday, around half of Republicans said they would oppose it within 24 hours. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican of Kentucky, declared there was no path forward for the legislation Tuesday afternoon. But Majority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat of New York, announced Wednesday morning that he would push for the Senate to advance a separate aid bill, effectively forcing Republicans to quickly say whether they stand where they stand on the Ukraine funding, which has been controversial within their caucus. Republicans in the House and Senate in recent months have balked at providing additional aid to the war-torn country unless it cleared a series of hurdles. The emergency aid bill lawmakers pivoted to would appropriate $60 billion for Ukraine's continued war against Russia.
Arguments in insurrection case to begin. The Supreme Court justices to decide if Trump can stay on the Colorado ballot. The U.S. Supreme Court on Thursday will consider whether former President Donald Trump's role in the January 6, 2021 attack on the U.S. Capitol disqualifies him from the presidency. The historic case could have huge consequences for this year's election if the justices decide that Trump, the frontrunner for the GOP nomination, is barred by the Constitution from returning to the White House. It's the biggest presidential election case since the Supreme Court decided Bush versus Gore in 2000, effectively handing the presidency to George W. Bush over then Vice President Al Gore. It's also a major test for the Supreme Court, which has been rocked by ethics scandals, criticism over its 2022 decision to overturn Roe v. Wade, and low public approval ratings. And it's not the only case about Trump the justices will be deciding. Trump is expected to appeal a lower court's ruling that he is not immune to criminal charges he tried to overturn the 2020 election. The Supreme Court is deciding whether Colorado's highest court was wrong to exclude Trump from Colorado's primary ballot. The state court said Trump is disqualified under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, an anti-insurrection provision added after the Civil War to keep government officials who sided with the Confederacy from returning to power. It's the first time the nation's highest court will hear a case on Section 3. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment bars people who took an oath to support the Constitution from holding office again if they engaged in insurrection. The clause says, "No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress or as an officer of the United States or as a member of any state legislature or as an executive or judicial officer of any state to support the Constitution of the United States shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability." 4 Republican and 2 independent voters in Colorado sued to keep Trump off the state's primary ballot. The voters include the lead plaintiff, Norma Anderson, a registered Republican. Anderson, 91, was the first female majority leader in both the Colorado House and Senate. After a 5-day trial last fall, a Colorado district judge ruled that Trump had engaged in an insurrection by inciting the mob that stormed the U.S. Capitol. But the judge also concluded that Section 3 of the 14th Amendment does not apply to a president. After the voters appealed, Colorado's top court in a 4-3 decision said the provision does apply to the presidency and disqualifies Trump from holding the office again. Of the dozens of challenges to Trump filed around the country, the Colorado case is the only one that has succeeded in court so far. Maine's Secretary of State, a Democrat, ruled in December that Trump is ineligible for that state's ballot. That decision, which Trump is appealing, is on hold until the Supreme Court rules in the Colorado case. A New Mexico judge last year disqualified county commissioner and Cowboys for Trump co-founder Cooey Griffin from holding public office for engaging in insurrection at the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Griffin has appealed that decision to the Supreme Court. Trump's main argument is Section 3 doesn't apply to presidents, and even if it did, he did not, quote, engage in insurrection. "There was no insurrection," his lawyers wrote in a filing. "President Trump did not incite anything, and President Trump did not engage in anything that constitutes insurrection."